brief announcements. First of all, in the interim, we created a joint housing subcommittee between Senator Tomasoni's housing and economic development budget division and this committee. Because of the way housing bills go, there was not really a central place for somebody to look at both finance and budget. And Ken Kielash, Senator Ken Kielash, has agreed to serve as chair. And Senator Dibble, Senator Fischbach, Senator Laurie, myself, Senator Tomasoni, and Senator Vanderveer are the ones on the committee. If somebody really wants to be on that committee, let us know. And for this committee, membership changed by one because Senator Wergen is no longer in the Senate, and so we are now a 13-member committee, so a quorum is now 7 people. And I wanted to quickly go through and introduce staff again. We have a couple of new people. For the most part, they're all the same. Laura Blubaugh, the committee administrator, is back again. Barb Jacobs, the LA for the committee, is new. Katie Kavanaugh from Senate Council and Research, and Dave Gill, don't know if he's going to be here today, but he's back again, as is Joan White, and David Godfrey, still our fiscal analyst. Majority research person is Mary Nino, and minority researcher is Lydia Uppas. She is new. And Carissa Maslowski, the returning committee page, will be with us again this year, but she's out today, so we have Chris, who's the committee page for Senator Murphy's committee, filling in. And with that, if nobody has any questions about that, so we do have 2 new people here with the committee. We have 2 bills on the agenda today and then a few confirmations to take care of. And the first bill of the session for this committee is Senator Sharon, Senate File 29.
Senate File, thank you very much, Chair. Chair Marty, I'm very excited to be your first order of business. Senate File 29 is a bill that we were planning to address a couple of issues related to cleaning up some language on vaccinations and an administrative language change on collaborative practice. However, I'd like to make an author's amendment before we begin to discuss the bill that would eliminate Section 1 of the bill in order to put the bill in the form that the author intends.
Senator Dahl moves to delete Section 1. Is there any discussion? Not all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
So if you then draw your attention to lines 2.23 and 2.24, this is the language that will be added to Subdivision 2 on prescribing and filing. And what this language does is include pharmacists in the list of practitioners who can write prescriptions and sign prescriptions legally to manage a patient's medications under a collaborative agreement. And in that collaborative agreement, these signatures would be allowed for managing patients' medications according to protocols that are established in the collaborative agreement for an individual patient. So this simply adds pharmacists to a group of people who are already able to do this. And if you notice, there's a reference to a statute, 151.01 subdivision 27, and that reference refers to the language about the practice of pharmacy and collaborative written protocol agreements between the physician and the pharmacist. I have with me Julie Johnson, who is the executive director of the Pharmacy Association, who will be glad to answer any specific questions you may have.
Ms. Johnson, did you have any statement you wanted to make, or just?
I don't think so. As Senator Marty and members of the committee, Senator Sharon, adequately articulated, I believe, the administrative change that's needed. Happy to answer any questions, of course.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I want to understand, is it currently the practice that pharmacists may not prescribe? And this is a way to permit that under certain circumstances? Is that the essential purpose here?
No. Senator Hahn, the purpose of this is clarification. In the instances where a pharmacist and a physician have a signed agreement that says, Julie Johnson, as a pharmacist, you can manage Senator Sharon's prescriptions for her asthma. Here are the drugs, and here's what you can do for this period of time. That allows the pharmacist to change doses, add under the specific protocol. What the problem is, when we do that, that's a prescription, and us signing it isn't valid unless we're added to the list of people that can do that. Is that clarified?
And so, Mr. Chairman, thank you for that. So what this contemplates is that there already are people that can sign prescriptions that are not physicians. Is that correct? And then you're asking for pharmacists to be added to this list of folks. Is that?
Yes. And as I described, what's happening now is these protocols are being signed by the physician and the pharmacist. And then each time the pharmacist changes a dose per the protocol, they have to run back to the physician and get it co-signed because it's not valid.
Okay.
And I just would add to that, thank you, Senator Marty, that undermines the whole purpose of the protocol and the collaborative agreement. If every time something changes, you have to go back to get the signature, then we've lost the value of developing the collaborative agreement and defining the protocol and the guidelines for the pharmacist to follow.
And Mr. Chairman, just one final question. I think the physicians, they're all okay with this, I assume, maybe not correctly, but I hope so. They're okay. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. We did run this language by them. In fact, the impetus behind this was we kept having to bug them to re-sign the prescription, so they actually are grateful.
They're already agreed upon what the right. what they can prescribe, but they're just able to change doses and stuff. Senator Berglund.
Well, I just want to say I think this is a small, important step, this bill, in terms of making the concept of medical homework better. That, physicians are managing people with chronic diseases, and sometimes there's fluctuations in a person's condition. And so if it's on record that the dosage can change when conditions change, that means they don't have to keep going back to the doctor every time they need that to happen also. A pharmacist is part of the medical home team.
Senator Sharon.
I would just supplement what Senator Berglund is saying. It also supports the recommendations of the healthcare reform process of having people practice to the highest level, to their scope of practice. And this was just a little technical thing that made the pharmacist do something that really undermined the whole objective of easing the system for the patients and for the medical system.
Senator Dow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it seems like a pretty common sense thing to do. I'm just curious how long this collaborative agreement's been going on. Is this something we just did recently, or how long has this practice been going on?
Senator Dole, we passed the initial language in 1999.
So, Mr. Chair, this almost 10 years has this been going on, and we haven't corrected until now? We haven't been approached on this?
Okay. Actually, our Senator Dole, our Board of Pharmacy brought it up and said we need this clarification. Okay. We consulted with pharmacists and physicians, and they said, yeah, we need that clarification.
Thank
Senator
you.
Dole, sometimes these things slip a long time. Last year when we were working on a pharmacy thing, we kind of noticed that you could not pick up drugs, technically speaking, for your spouse or your kids or anybody, the way the law was written, and nobody was enforcing it that way, but it would be a real right. problem to do, and I don't know how long the law had been that shape, but it had been a number of years.
Okay.
So, is there further discussion on Senator Sharon's bill? Mr. Weiberg, do you want to speak to the bill or two questions or correct something we've been saying?
No, everything is perfectly correct. My name is Dr. Cody Weiberg. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Pharmacy, and I've been directed by the board to speak in favor of this bill. We did work with the Pharmacy Association, with the College of Pharmacy as well. And as Julie Johnson mentioned, we contacted them and suggested this change. We are very much in favor of it. We think this does allow pharmacists to practice up to the full extent of their abilities. It still leaves the physician or the practitioner in the driver's seat. And the other thing I'd like to add is that I was on a task force, a work group, actually, that the health department had that was looking at the primary care workforce shortages in healthcare. And there are a couple of folks from the health department who arranged for and ran that work group. This is an issue that that work group discussed, and it was an issue on which there was consensus to support this exact language. And in fact, at that work group were representatives of the Minnesota Medical Association and the Minnesota Academy of Family Physicians. And they had both gone back to their respective organizations, and those organizations stated through them that they were not opposed at all to this. In fact, the gentleman who represented the Minnesota Academy of Family Practitioners just assumed pharmacists could do this already. So.
Is there further discussion? Anybody in the audience who wanted to speak with concerns about the bill? If not, Senator Dowell moves that Senate File 29 be recommended to pass. No further discussion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Sharon, for having the first bill, you didn't get beat up to it.
No, thank you very much.
Let's Senator Higgins, Senate File 30.
Mr. Chair, I have Senate File 30, and it deals with precursor drugs used to make meth. Mr. Chair and members, I serve as the legislative member to the Minnesota Gang and Drug Oversight Council, or the Senate legislative member. This year, the Oversight Council heard from law enforcement that despite the measures that the legislature took in 2005, they were still seeing meth labs pop up in greater Minnesota, especially in southern Minnesota. Law enforcement attributes these labs to what is called smurfing, which is where someone goes from pharmacy to pharmacy and obtains the precursor drugs in each place. With the legislation in 2005 that required logs to be kept at the pharmacies, we curbed much of this behavior. But the officers in greater Minnesota are finding that smaller pharmacies are unclear about the legislature's intent on sharing the logs with law enforcement. This bill would clarify that the logs should be kept for 3 years and that they should be open to law enforcement at all reasonable times. This bill also clarifies, basically it clarifies what the intent of the 2005 legislation was. And I have here with me today Mr. Bob Bushman, the coordinator of the statewide Gang and Drug Oversight Council.
Good afternoon.
Welcome to the committee.
Glad to be here, sir. Senator.
Do you have any statement you wanted to make? Or?
Yes, I'll just tell you that in my role as statewide coordinator, I talk with all the gang and drug task forces throughout the state, you know, about issues that come up, and this is one of them that surfaced this year. While most of the retailers and pharmacists are happy to comply with law enforcement in keeping track of pseudoephedrine sales, there are some that seem to be confused exactly about what the intent was or what they're required to do. There is no requirement currently in the law that requires logs to be retained for any specific time. And we believe that if we could just get the change made to open their logs to inspection or get the information to law enforcement when they need it, that would be a pretty easy fix to the number of problems that we're having. In 2007, the task forces in Minnesota seized or dismantled 33 methamphetamine labs. Through the first three quarters of this year, we were over 40, so we have seen an increase this past year. And the majority of those had to do with these cases that Senator Higgins was talking about, smurfing, or people buying multiple quantities of pseudoephedrine at different pharmacies in the area.
And I was just curious about that because I thought that now the log was done, I thought it was always electronically done. It's not always electronically done?
It is not. There are some that just have it written in notebooks. There isn't any specified uniformity either as to how those logs are kept.
And the federal law doesn't, does that require at some point we're going to have to, because I know the federal law had, I thought some state I once bought some, and I thought they required you to sign something that they said was recorded under federal law as well as state law.
There is federal legislation that requires it, but then again, there's a lot of confusion, particularly on the parts of smaller operations, exactly what they're supposed to do to comply with state or federal laws.
Okay. Senator Hand and Senator Berglund.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The pharmacies that you are suggesting have been unclear, I assume have been refusing then access to the logs when they have been requested by law enforcement. And what is their concern? Why would they not want to provide that, even though the law doesn't specifically require it? That was part of the intent, was to cut down on the usage. But what has been the concern, or why have they not been willing to do this? Have they given any reason?
Yes, Senator Hahn. It's been my experience that some pharmacies believe that they are actually violating the HIPAA laws, you know, that it's a doctor-patient privilege, which is not in effect because these are not prescription, these are not prescription drugs. And there are some that, frankly, believe that because they're not required to do so, they don't want to, and they don't.
And, Mr. Chairman, just another question. I guess I was kind of wondering about that, if there are any issues about privacy with respect to people who are purchasing these medications. Would they be concerned that their use of these drugs would be available on request by law enforcement without subpoena or without any other legal process? Is that an issue potentially? Or, I mean, are we going to have challenges to this on the basis of that?
Well, Senator, I would imagine there's always some people that have that concern. Yes.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Hahn, if you look on page 2, starting about line 18 or thereabouts, it shows what the seller must do in the way of collecting the information. We don't require that that they take a photocopy of the driver's license. We don't require addresses. We require them to check to see that they're old enough, that they're 18 years old or older. They have to provide a photo ID that shows their date of birth, and then they sign in the log in either a written paper copy or an electronic copy. So we could have been a lot more stringent in the information we collect, but we did not. So I think that the information we collect is appropriate, and it does not go too far.
Senator Berglund and Senator Lynch.
This was exactly the intention of the law when it was passed. We never put a time limit on it, but the intention was that the records would be retained for the purposes of law enforcement to review them, and it was intended not only to sort of curtail meth labs because the product was pretty easily available, but it was also to curtail this idea of sort of pharmacy hopping. And if law enforcement doesn't have access to the records, it would be pretty hard for them to be able to enforce that.
Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Higgins, thank you for bringing this forward. I have a question on line 2.24. The verbiage that says at all reasonable times, what does that mean, and why is there a reason that those words are included?
Mr. Chair and Senator Lynch, we're seeing that as kind of business hours. You know, we don't want somebody to call up at 3 in the morning and say, you know, meet me at the pharmacy in 10 minutes. I need to look at your log. It's a reasonable, is there a legal term of reasonableness? I don't know. But that's kind of what we were thinking, was that, you know, during business hours, at appropriate times, that kind of thing.
Is there further discussion?
Just a minute.
Yes.
And Mr. Bushman wants to.
Senator Lynch, in some of the cases that have been investigated, there have been some long delays in getting the information from the pharmacies or from the retailers while they would research or check with legal counsel to decide really what their responsibilities were. Mm-hmm. And sometimes those delays have been delays in law enforcement being able to actually, you know, catch people cooking meth or go get the lab cleaned up before it poses a potential hazard. So we're not looking for something that makes them, you know, jump every time we ask, but if we could have access to them during business hours or avoid lengthy delays that may hamper the investigation.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a question maybe for you. Is this bill going to the Judiciary Committee from
here? Yes, they have requested the bill, yes.
Okay, then, Mr. Chair, I'll move that Senate File 30 be recommended to pass and be referred to Judiciary Committee.
Any discussion? Anybody in the audience had concerns about the bill? Not all those in favor of Senator Higgins' motion say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you.
Good job.
We have a few confirmations to deal with quickly, and I think we'll start with the Housing Finance Agency confirmations. We have two board members and a new commissioner, and I believe at least one of the board members is present, and the new commissioner is here as well, if I understand correctly. Mr. Goulet and Commissioner, welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll open it up by just asking if either of you want to make any statements or make a pitch or anything.
Well, I thought I'd make a statement. Just my name is Dan Bartholomew. I'm the new Housing Commissioner, Minnesota Housing Commissioner, pending your approval here today. It's a great opportunity for me to step up and lead an important agency, one of the best housing finance agencies in the state. I'm very well aware of the issues that face housing and the asset that the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency is to the state of Minnesota and to its citizens, and will do all I can to serve well both the people and the communities of the state in a judicious and very thoughtful manner.
Mr. Goulet?
My name is Tony Goulet. I've been in the industry for pretty much my entire career. Housing has been very important to me in serving on the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency Board for affordable housing is a privilege to be able to do that. One of the things that I do realize after serving in this industry for this length of time is that the affordable housing is important to all of us to be able to get people into housing. It helps their entire society. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions from the committee. Senator Fischbach.
Mr. Chair, I don't have a question, but I would just like to mention that Mr. Goulet is a constituent of mine, and I'm familiar with his work and have had the opportunity to meet him, and would offer my full support. And, Mr. Chair, if at the appropriate time, I would like to make the motion to support his.
Good. And Ms. Bostrom was unable to attend. We invited her to send a letter if she wanted, but I don't know if we received one. Did you have any, Commissioner, do you? Or
I believe it has been sent.
Oh, okay. I don't know that, we don't require a letter or anything, just wanted to make sure people have the opportunity to. And does anybody have any questions or concerns? I would like to, as the Commissioner, I've been asking every Commissioner who we confirm now because of some concerns in the past, not particularly with the Housing Finance Agency, but wanted to ask for a commitment that the commissioner recognizes that their job is not to represent the governor or the legislature, but to serve the people of Minnesota. And we fully expect and understand that you're presenting the governor's and the administration's positions, but also my request is that you commit to what I think is likely anyway, and that is that you be honest about what you see the needs of the agency and if you have concerns about the direction, in other words, like when you're presenting the agency budget, you're presenting the budget that the governor and the agency of the administration agrees to, but if you feel, for instance, that there's a crisis that's not being addressed, that you'd say, personally, I feel there's a crisis as a, in your case, housing professional, that you express your own opinion, recognizing that that's not the agency's opinion, that's not what you're pushing, you're just in response to questions or whatever, you're being honest about what your professional judgment would be. And I recognize there's a difference between presenting a bill and also if we ask you something. I guess I'd like to ask for your commitment that you'll be as honest as you can as a professional in explaining your concerns if we ask about them.
Yes, I would agree to do that. I mean, I believe that one of the things I bring to the table is a transparency and honesty in everything that I've done and would continue to do that.
And I appreciate you also, when we met, we talked also about the Respecting Open Meeting Law and Data Practices Act and not encouraging people to keep things out. Don't put anything in writing because there's a paper trail then, and about the commitment that you won't punish employees for speaking out as citizens on their own as long as they're not speaking out on behalf of the agency. And I think you indicated both of those were things you thought were fair. And I appreciate that very much. And I want to say that I'm not familiar with Mr. Goulet, but I've heard very wonderful things about the commissioner designate, and we wish you the best because
you've
got a lot of difficult challenges ahead.
It's a wild time, but
it is. Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, while we have you in front of us, which is pretty rare in this committee, I just wondered if you could talk about any new directions or any new things that you hope to bring to the agency or any new proposals that you hope to be involved in as a part of working.
Sure. I mean, I guess, I have worked in the housing realm for quite a while with the McKnight Foundation for the last 13 years, and so I bring a pretty strong understanding of the field and the partnerships that are required to move in affordable housing along. We're obviously in a challenging time that has an impact on, as a finance agency, on our ability to do our job. We're sorting that through right now. But I would say that what I bring to the table is a desire, one, to help the community as a whole understand that affordable housing is an asset rather than a liability, something that is really a asset and a platform for success for families and individuals, and that our communities require a certain amount of housing stock to serve the variety of needs, and many of the communities that we have across the state are not accepting of that at this point. And I think it's really important to acknowledge that this is really almost an infrastructure piece of our communities, that if we don't have enough affordable housing, our staff, our employees, businesses really can't thrive. So that's one of the larger, kind of bigger picture themes that I want to bring to the table. Secondly is the importance of collaboration and working across sectors, public, private, and nonprofit partnerships. The agency has been very good at doing that in the past. I think there's some work to build on there, in particular getting more private sector involvement. So that'd be another thing that I'd want to bring forward. In the short term, we are in the process of dealing a lot with foreclosure issues, and those things have, it's been mounting over the last few years, but it's pretty acute right now. We are in the process of receiving and funds from the federal government, the Neighborhood Stabilization Program funds, which we're in the first round on that. I anticipate that there will be additional funds that will be allocated by the federal government in the coming months. I can't be certain of that, but I think it's a good shot, and that we will use this first round to learn how best to use those funds in the coming year. That being said, I guess I'm always looking for opportunities for alignment, both of people resources but financial resources, and I think there may be some ways to continue to align these resources for greater benefit, meaning that I think housing located near transportation, transit-friendly housing, if you want to call it that, is very important when you think about the family's ability to afford housing. Transportation and housing costs together combined are the largest costs in a family's budget right now. And so thinking about housing and its relationship to other infrastructure investments, for instance, transit and transportation, I think is also critically important as a leader in the field.
Sarah Lynch, did you have? Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And a question for Commissioner. It would. I'm interested to know if you could provide the committee with some information regarding any conversations or discussions that you may be having with regard to the federal stimulus package that is pending, and if you have had any interactions, and what is our position? What is Minnesota's position with regard to those discussions?
Well, we've been tracking the bills pretty carefully through a national network, the National Council for Housing Finance Agencies. They're kind of our trade association nationally. They have staff on the Hill. They spend a lot of time tracking these things. We've worked with them on a platform that is really consistent with the needs of all the HFAs across the country. So there's a number of items that this NCSHA is pushing for relative to housing. As far as a larger, you know, stance on the stimulus bill, we're really representing the housing field in that. If you felt it was useful for us to share some of the things that have come out of the public documents that might have come out of some of these associations that we have, we could share that with you, which would lay out some of the things that are pending. I don't know if that's what you were asking for.
Mr. Chair and Commissioner, let me try again. I guess what I'm more interested or what I'm thinking is that, you know, that's all good and well that there have been some summaries done and there are some drafts out there. But proactively, as the housing commissioner for Minnesota, are we involved with our federal delegation in terms of providing input? It doesn't. I'm fearful that we're not, and I'm hopeful that your leadership will that would be something that you would find to make a priority.
Well, it is. I mean, I've been in the job now for a little over 2 months, and I've met with several of our legislators in Washington when I had a chance to be out there to talk to them generally about this. This was before the current bill has really gotten shaped up. I will be going back there in early March, although this piece may be already in play by then. But we have been meeting with our senators and legislators when they're in town to talk to them, brief them about the issues that we have in the housing finance field and ways that their work can help us address those issues. So from a housing vantage point, we're very involved to the extent that we can be, I think, in terms of reaching out and contacting and working with our legislators and senators to let them know and educate them about the issues. So we've been doing that in a proactive way. Beyond that, I mean, that seems in the short term to be my role to advocate for good housing policy. I'm not in a position and at this point in time to advocate for a whole stimulus package. I mean, because my realm is the housing realm right now, and that's what I'm most paying attention to.
Senator Higgins.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, the NSP funds, I know the state and the designated local governments had to have their plans to HUD by December 1st or thereabouts. Have we gotten any of the money back to the states yet? Have the plans been approved and the funds come back?
Our NSP money? Well, the plan, a preliminary plan has been basically approved, but it's pending some final approvals, but we are going to be receiving requests or proposals from the local communities that will be actually the implementers of this later this month. I think it's the 27th of January is our proposal deadline. So we're in the process right now of developing all the infrastructure inside our department to receive and score those proposals and then to get the money out there. The requirement of the NSP money is that the money must be spent within 18 months of commitment. So once we get to that point where we've selected the proposals, our partners who are implementing the plans, their local plans, will have 18 months to spend the money. And we'll be tracking that fairly carefully to make sure that the ones that we do choose to invest in are fulfilling their obligation to carry that out, because the money that they don't spend would be available for other communities to work with. So we're well on our way in that process, and we expect to be fully in place within compliance once it's up and running.
And Mr. Chair, Commissioner, when will the money arrive?
I believe the money would arrive about a month and a half to 2 months after the plans are approved for expenditures that were in their agreements. So I don't know if that's helpful. I think it's about right. Yeah. So hopefully, once the plans are in place and people start working on it, we'll be able to pay it down as the projects go forward on an incremental basis as the funding needs arise. But there will be a commitment in place to work with those communities to fund at that level that we make a commitment to at the end of this process.
And Mr. Chair and Commissioner, Do you expect to just be the pass-through for, I mean, once you've set the criteria and chosen the local units of government that are going to be getting the state funds, are you just going to pass the money through, or do you
mostly? I mean, we want to use the funds in a way that has as much impact as possible, but also serves the broader needs of the state community. So we went through a fairly careful process of selecting those areas, and this funds are really for concentrated foreclosure areas. It's neighborhood stabilization, so it's focused on the highest need areas in the state. Okay, now we are going to be passing those through because they are essentially community development block grant funds, and the issues with community development block grant is that there's some compliance issues with federal compliance issues. So we want to pass that money through agencies that are used to have actually had some experience complying with that source of money, in order to make sure that we don't run into problems on the back end. So the answer is basically a pass-through. We hope to use this first round, assuming that there may be a second round that comes through, to learn how to use those funds most effectively. So that may change a bit. How we go about that may change a bit if there's a future source of more of these monies.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep.
Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I just had a comment. I am delighted about your appointment. And the reason I say this is because I know of your history. You may not know that I know about your history. Uh-oh. But I know about your work with the McKnight Foundation and the work that you did with low-income communities to really bring together a strong coalition of people that work for economic development and affordable housing in McKnight Foundation. And so I just wanted to express my support for your appointment and let the members know that I am very pleased that you are in this position and very hopeful that we can work with this administration in projects that would really have a tremendous impact on low-income communities. And we have a great need, as you know, today. So I look forward to connect with you and the agency to continue the work that you started several years ago with the foundation.
Thank you.
Senator Dow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to echo something that you had said earlier about a little more of the transparency and who the commissioners work for, who we all work for, is the state of Minnesota. And I saw this with Commissioner Sorrell at the Transportation Department when he put out his organizational chart, and at the very top of the list was citizens of the state of Minnesota. And I think that keeps our perspectives in place, and as we're setting priorities and communicating with each other and setting up partnerships, so we know who we really work for. And Commissioner, what I would like to ask is I liked everything you said about collaboration and alignment and the effect of looking at transit-oriented housing and things like that. I see on your list here of your resume that you also worked with the Governor's Climate Change Advisory Committee and the Itasca Project. I know that concerns about energy efficiency and things like that, weatherization is going to be a key, and affordable housing, operating those homes is a key component of that. Will you be working as well to then, in terms of dollars and focus on helping, kind of funnel some of that money as well that you'll be coming in contact with or managing to work with groups that are doing weatherization and those kind of projects, so that the buildings or the homes that we're helping to rehab or make available are ones that we're not having to now subsidize on the back end as well to operate, especially in the cold weather season?
Yeah, I would. I'm a very strong proponent of trying to integrate those ideas into the housing that we build. There's actually a Green Communities Initiative, and all of the housing that we do in the MHFA is intended to move in the direction of green, which is energy efficient, et cetera, for the reasons you mentioned. And so I'm a strong supporter of that. I do think, though, in addition to the buildings themselves, the placement of the housing is also a critical element of that. So I bundle that together to be both where the housing is located relative to jobs and transportation as being one layer, and then the buildings themselves being another, and then the sites that they're on being a third layer, which is maybe less around the efficiency but more around the environmental impact that housing sites have on water retention and things of that nature. So that is a current priority that I will maintain to go forward.
And Mr. Chair, if I may, and thank you, Commissioner. I appreciate to hear that. Now, The other part is, you know, money flows through your agency. One of the things, you know, is looking at when we talk about energy efficiencies and especially in low-income neighborhoods and how to get people back to work is getting money to the contractors to do some of these retrofits. Has there been any discussions within your agency on how you might help facilitate that, being able to help get money into contractors' hands to do energy retrofits, or is that something that we'd have to look elsewhere for?
Well, our goal is affordable housing overall, so we're talking about a smaller portion of the overall market or rehab market, but we have had conversations about prioritizing more of our funds in the short term towards rehab versus new development, partly because of the economic times, and that can be actually a helpful stimulant package to help, at least in our own way, to encourage development that can happen quickly and keep people employed. So we've had that conversation. We're trying to think of ways to steer those resources as best we can to short-term stuff. At the same time, we don't want to forego our longer-term vision for what we can do with housing. But we know we're going to have to adjust that a little bit in the short term, given the budget deficits and all the rest of it, and maybe focus a little bit more on the rehab stuff in the short term.
Thanks.
Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Commissioner, kind of having a wide-ranging conversation here, I appreciate your patience. Just wondering if you would care to comment or give your perspective. It's been reported, at least with respect to the national policies regarding affordable housing and the structure of financing, there's been some reports to suggest that those policies, at least in part, were a contributing factor to some of the mortgage problems that have been so catastrophic. And I am just curious to see if you have any insight into that structure and how it may work in Minnesota, and whether or not we have appropriate processes in place to make sure that we are not encouraging the acquisition of mortgages that are beyond the capacity of folks who have them to afford them. Is that a concern, or is that something that we should be concerned about, or just any comment you might want to make on
that?
Well,
I mean, I think in broad strokes, it's a broader concern. Not everybody should own a home. And the reality is that in many cases, people who did become homeowners maybe weren't well positioned to be homeowners. On the other hand, in the case of MHFA, our customers are very successful in their homes. And that has a lot to do with homeownership counseling, which prepares people to understand what it means to own a home. And so I think that there's a little bit of a misunderstanding. Maybe it's an issue around whether people were educated well enough before they owned their homes to be successful, rather than the policies pushing banks and others to finance folks that weren't ready. I think that none of the rules at the federal level require banks to loan to people who aren't sufficiently qualified. They do encourage folks to lend in areas that can be discriminated against, et cetera. But it's still up to the financing agencies to actually do that due diligence and underwriting work. And I think a lot of that's really where the problem was more on the underwriting side of things. And then the inability, by virtue of the structures, to go back and find out when you have the mortgage-backed securities and you have poor underwriting to begin with, becomes more difficult to deal with problem loans after the fact. So I don't know if that answered your question or not. But.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, I just had one comment in regard to the conversation that we've been having about a potential stimulus package, and that is that there were a number of proposals from my district that went into the State Housing Finance Agency, and before those proposals were funded, the governor unallotted those funds. And those were construction jobs in my district that would have taken place. Those were jobs to retrofit abandoned, foreclosed homes. I hope we do get money from the federal government to help do these kinds of things, but I think it's unfortunate that we had to unallot the money that would have been spent by the state during the next 6 months on this effort ourselves.
There are further
discussion on any of the appointments? If not, Senator Fischbach moves. Senator Fischbach, you'd be willing to move both of the board members. I'd like to take them separately. But could you move both commission member,
Mr. Chair, member, whatever Mr. works Bullitt? Out, I will be happy to do.
Thank you for doing it. I'll point out that Ms. Bostrom is a constituent of mine and works in the affordable housing finance field. But Senator Higgins moves that, Senator Fischbach, I'm sorry, moves that Tony Goulet and Gloria Bostrom be confirmed as members of the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency Board. Is there any discussion on that motion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Torres-Ray, would you be willing to move Commissioner Bartholomew's appointment?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
On that motion, Senator Torres-Ray moves that Daniel Bartholomew be confirmed as Commissioner of the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. Is there any discussion of that motion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Congratulations to both
Thank
of you.
You.
And I'll point out, before you leave, we are going to the Housing Joint Housing Subcommittee. Senator Kelash is hoping to have the first meeting on February 4th. And we're anticipating about three hearings total. And when we do that, because that committee, Senator Fischbach, Senator Lori, and myself are on it from this committee, and Senator Tomasoni's committee meets right after ours. So on days where we have those meetings, we'll probably adjourn a little early and work a little bit into their committee time as well. But thank you very much for coming. We look forward to working with you.
Great. Thank you.
Now, the Emergency Medical Services Regulatory Board is Catherine Burke Moore. Yes, she is here. Welcome to the committee. It's the first time to see you outside of the role of Department of Public Safety and DWI and other such things.
A long time, yes.
Yes.
Thank you.
And the eight board members who are being confirmed, none of them are able to be here. But did you want to just give a paragraph statement about what the board does again and any concerns or any thoughts you want to pass on?
Just briefly. The Emergency Medical Services Regulatory Board is considered a health licensing board, and we oversee ambulance personnel as well as ambulance services. We license training programs, ambulance services, medical response units, and certified emergency personnel. We issue about 15,000 licenses a year. We have oversight. We take in complaints. We do investigations. We issue compliance orders and correction orders, and actually do a summary approval of primary service areas, which can be interesting with the services if they overlap. When I say we do oversight, I think it's really important with the regulatory board that I think our first responsibility is to ensure and assist our licensees to comply. And only if they're unable to would we take action. But I think our role is not just to regulate and correct, but actually assure that they have the resources that they need to comply with statute and rule. We also manage 28 grants statewide, and we manage a MnSTAR, which collects ambulance run data, and a MnTrack system for the Department of Health, which tracks EMS readiness for hazard situations and emergency incidents. And we've got a number of different responsibilities as well.
Thank you. And this is the board that until last year, 2 years ago or so, had term limit of one term per board member. And we changed that to two, or is it unlimited now?
I'm going to double check with Deb. I thought it was unlimited.
Of these eight people who have been nominated, are any of them return members?
I did not check that. Come on up, Deb. That's why I brought Debbie.
Yes, thank you. Welcome to the committee, and please identify
yourself.
Thank
you.
2006 in here.
None of them are return.
Okay, well, the continuity of the board hasn't increased yet, but I'm sure that change will someday have an impact. Senator Higgins and Senator.
Mr. Chair,
I'm sorry, didn't catch your name.
Last name is Burkmore, Catherine Burkmore.
Oh, I'm sorry. Hello. Do we have any people of color on this board? Do we have any people with disabilities? I'm looking at that open application form, and I see a couple that don't have anything marked in that box at all, but do we have any diversity on this board of any kind at all?
Not as far as ethnicity, and if there is as far as disability, it's not one that's been shared with us.
Mr. Chair, the other question I had was, we have some of these applications forms are from 2006. Have we not had an opportunity to act on this in that amount of time?
Some of these are older appointments, and I've only been in the position for 2 months. So, Deb, are you aware whether there were confirmations in the last two sessions?
There were not confirmations.
Mr. Chair?
However, the people have been serving on the board.
Mr. Chair, does this give you a full complement on the board now?
Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins, we currently have two vacant positions, and they've recently become vacant. If you want to, I can actually send out a handout on our board makeup at this time. The two vacant positions, we have a public member that just recently went off our board due to conflicts with time, and our state representative. We need to have a state representative reappointed. Representative Moe had been the representative.
Mr. Chair, then my only comment is I think it's unacceptable to have no people of color and no people with disabilities in this this type of a board that clearly works throughout our state with all communities and I am really disappointed that there wasn't, I don't know what kind of outreach was done to get folks to apply to this board, but I'm going to be voting against the recommendation, if there is a recommendation to approve today, solely on the fact that we have no diversity on this board whatsoever.
Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins, what I wish that you would do would give me an opportunity to make a difference. When we don't fill our board positions, we have, I'm hoping the handout is being handed out. Yes. We have so many people on committees that really do a lot of work for the state on this board. And with fewer people, work will fall through the cracks and we will not serve the state well. I understand what you're saying, and I think you're making good points. If you look at our list, we look to volunteer, we look to fire, we look to family physicians to appoint. I think that we can make it really clear that we would like to see those recommendations show diversity as well. But I've not had that opportunity, so I would wish that you would not. I wish you'd give me an opportunity to make a difference.
Well, and Mr. Chair and Ms. Burke, I'll be looking forward to your outreach to make sure that we start getting underrepresented groups represented in. Starting with this board and throughout the work that you do.
Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins, one thing that I think I am proud about this board is it very much is statewide, and it really does represent this is such a broad board from an EMT to doctors, and we do have that covered very well. But you're right, we can make it more diverse still, but I'm very pleased with we have people statewide, so we're not just metro-focused, we're not just rural-focused. So it really gives us, I think, some very good decisions because it is diverse in that sense, but we can be better.
Senator Prittner-Sowen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, this handout has been very helpful to me. I was questioning the regional representation and also the areas of practice that were represented on the board, and this is very helpful. Thank you.
Thank you.
And we're kind of puzzled by where the recommendations were because some of these were 2 years old, and we did confirm the appointments 2 years ago, so these must not have somehow come through because our committee didn't have them. But anyway, they are here now. Is there anybody who had other questions or discussion about the appointment? Senator Lori.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Burkmore, are you up for confirmation? Is Ms. Burkmore up for confirmation too right now? Is that?
Mr. Chair, yeah. Senator, I'm actually hired by the board of directors, so I'm not a governor's appointee.
Okay, so we don't confirm. It's on our list here, and I was wondering, there was nothing in the packet.
She's just here to present for them because none of the board.
Okay, I was confused.
Nominees could be here. So, yes. And Mr. Doyle, you were here, but you're not. You could answer questions if somebody had questions. Is there further discussion from members of the committee? If not, can we have a nomination for the Sarah Laurie moves that, better read the names, that Dawn Bidwell, Bonnie Engen, James Reber, Mari Thomas, Brenda Brown, Elizabeth Kanzi, Paula Fink-Koken, and Paul Satterley be confirmed as members of the Emergency Medical Services Regulatory Board. If there is no further discussion of that motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Hand.
Can I just ask a question? Trying to reconcile, in your motion, you did not list Susan Jacobson, although she's on the list and in the packet. Is that?
Whoops.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hahn, Laura and I had been in communication. Susan Jacobson is no longer on the board, and she had been on just went off the board and will be filling that fire position as well.
Right. Thank you.
Well, she would probably this public member. That's
further speaking. Discussion on this issue. If there's no other business, we're planning to, the committee is planning to meet next Monday, and look forward to seeing you then. With that, no further business. The committee's adjourned.
Mr. Chair. Sorry, before you.
Committee is not yet adjourned.
Before you dismiss the committee, I just wanted to make sure that I voice my strong support for Senator Higgins' comments. And since we have two vacant positions, I would like to urge the committee to be proactive in asking you to please do extensive recruitment to bring on board people that really represent the groups that Senator Higgins described today, meaning populations of color, minorities, American Indian, and people with disabilities. I think that you have an opportunity to fill those positions with individuals who have this background, and I will encourage you to do it so that we don't have to have this conversation again when you come back for the appointment of those two vacant positions. And in the future, too, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I think that we need to be proactive in sending a message to the governor in terms of appointments, that we really want to see an effort to recruit from communities that we usually don't see from this administration. And I think I'm going to be really looking forward to a change in that direction.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ray, I would like to say that these appointments actually come from will go to the law enforcement, will go to the Sheriff's Association for those appointments, so they do not come from the governor's office. But with those same associations and groups, we can send this message very clear that we would like to look within their membership to add an additional diversity to this board. But I did want to make sure that you understood this. These are not governor's appointees. These are these individual bodies that are listed as in the representing county. The representing column. That's who appoints to the board. But that message can go to them. And I will be happy to send that.
And appreciate your passing on. I think it's a point well taken. With that, this committee is adjourned.
Thank you.
I think that would be great. I think the majority leaders do.